Welcome to Programming Languages Today. Okay. Today we're going to have as our topic metaprogramming. So let's start right in. And the general concept that we're going to see throughout this session is a statement like, let's write a program that writes a program. So we are now starting to manipulate the program that is currently run at the program or generates some other program that is later on called and all such. So the general principle is that there is some kind of code created during the either compile or runtime of a program that's not immediately visible and will only be assembled a little bit later on. So what we're going to see throughout today's session are several tools or principles that can be seen as particular instances of metaprogramming, and this starts off with a very down-to-earth technique, which is just usual compilers or compiler tools. We're going to then go over to things that help the development of a program, like preprocessors for syntax rewriting. You will probably already have seen stuff that uses preprocessors, but maybe not in the way that we're going to tackle today. And we're going to go over to reflections and metaclasses, which is already, well, also common knowledge in a particular sense, but can also be seen as ways for metaprogramming. This can be then deepened into what is known as the Meta Object Protocol, and in the last instance we're going to see how macros will influence the way that we see metaprogramming. So let's dive right in. So what we already have seen in the last session was aspect-oriented programming, and this was already one step into the direction of metaprogramming, in the sense that we would refine the code that is defined once at a particular place at another place by means of a program in a certain sense, or a specification in the case of the aspect-oriented programming. So within the aspect-oriented code, we would treat the target program where we want to attach to as kind of our data that we want to manipulate in a certain way. And, well, you could wonder whether you could drive this aspect to be more of the major design principle of your program concept. And, well, what this all boils down to is to have some way of treating the program code as a ordinary data element that you can just process within the program code that you have. And, well, depending on the degree of action that you can do with this code, then this is, well, the way to metaprogramming, starting from very simple things like just being able to read program code in form of usual data structures, with the goal to, at the end, manipulate the program code as you would manipulate data structures, and do that at runtime to your current program, for example. So this is like the ultimate goal in metaprogramming, if you want to push it to the limits. So the general concepts we have said is treat program as data, read and analyze or even transform programs, not necessarily your own, but in the ultimate goal you would manipulate your own program, and do that not only during compile time but even during runtime. So these are these two dimensions that you can manipulate there. So there's whether you manipulate your own program, or whether you do that during compile time or during runtime. So these are like the two dimensions. So let's start off with first go, which would be code generation tools. So this is like the very lowest tier of metaprogramming facilities, and they are widely used in areas like compiler construction. And there are usually some tools that you can obtain that specify definitions of code that that will later on be compiled into some target language in form of a domain-specific language. And usual examples are these tools Lex and Bison. I don't know, is there anyone who does not know Lex and Bison? Wow, okay, so I don't tell you anything new there. So this is like just usual scanner and parser generators where you can specify lexicographic patterns in the scanner generator and just grammars based on the tokens that you specified in your scanner in the parser generator, and use that in order to build up like a data representation of the input file that you parsed with these two tools in order to then treat them as data elements of your language. So as an example, you see here a very, very small example for how the scanner generator works. Well, what you essentially do is on a very high level, you specify how the lexical pattern looks like, and then in this case, we directly react to such a pattern occurring in the input by specifying the code that is to be executed at that point, and then connect that into a main routine by calling it with a predefined method. And this is already an example that generates over 1,000 lines of C code. Well, there's a lot of optimizations going on in the background. This is not your naive code generation in the sense that it does not really construct like your the first automaton that that there is without any optimizations, and then tries to implement that in terms of programming languages like C in a naive way. But there's a lot of optimization steps in between, and those generate a lot of lines of code then. Anyway, this is only barely touching the topic of metaprogramming, since, well, of course, you can with that make program code into something that you can access as data, but it might not have been the stuff that you have been dreaming of when you heard of metaprogramming. So let's go on a little bit further and have a look at what we call preprocessors. And the people that have already worked with C or C++ have usually had some, if not a lot of, contact to preprocessors. So is there anyone in here who has not programmed C so far? Well, so you should all be quite familiar to what the preprocessor does then. So usually what you get with the C preprocessor, or CPP in short, is a system that lets you specify like a set of text rewriting rules that are applied to whatever code is underneath. There's no such thing as some kind of type checking involved in that. It can be arbitrary code to which this C preprocessor can be applied to, and you can even use it completely separated from the C++ world if you like to do so. All you need to do is like to define your rules with this introducing hash thing, and then like define a particular macro by giving it some name and maybe even parameters, and then provide some kind of implementation of the whole thing afterwards. And this can, in principle, be applied to any code that will follow the whole thing or will be put also into this C preprocessor. Like, what you can do is, for example, in the GCC world, what you can do is, like, call it in GCC with minus E, and then whatever file you'd like to provide to that, and this will just use this thing in a pure preprocessor manner and will rewrite any matches of the rules that were defined in CPP format in these sources and output the files in the rewritten form. So with that, you can just use the preprocessor by its own, for example. And, well, what you can do with such things is that you can use them wherever, like, the type system or even, like, the syntactical boundaries that you have in your language prohibit you from expressing something that you would like to achieve. So this can usually boils down to some kind of hack or something that is trying to establish mechanisms that don't really don't have a real correspondence in the underlying language. Like, you can use at the definition sides of such macros, the things that you use there don't necessarily have to be valid statements or valid expressions. You can have an unmatched number of opened or closed parentheses, for example, that, well, doesn't really matter. It's not type checked in any way. So with that, you can start to be real creative and well, do things that are not possible in your original language. So what are these usually used to? Well, you might find that they are often used to inline some kind of more complicated expressions. And yeah, well, what have we as examples here? So this is an example with a min function that is defined here with min x and y is then replaced by this conditional expression, like if x is smaller than y, then return x, or in another case, y. And this can be applied, for example, to this first thing here, and will then yield the expression over there after being applied. You have to be a little bit cautious, because the things that you put into these macros as parameters are taken literally. What does that mean? Well, if you, for example, construct things like the one from the following example here, where you have this post-increment operator, for example, well, this is a text rewriting system. So essentially, all the parameters get copied to all the occurrences of the variables in the pattern. This means that the complete expression that is in there goes then. If this expression has side effects, for example, well, they are to be applied at each and every occurrence of that variable, which means that, well, you get the variable to be incremented twice here in this particular example. So that's the major difference between this and the ordinary method call in that sense. In this here, you take the parameters literally as just text fragments, and the only thing that you can do is duplicating, inserting them at certain positions, completely ignore the semantics of these things. In function calls, you will evaluate and then only work with the values afterwards. So there's a few caveats that you get when you, a few things that you have to pay attention to if you do that. So yeah, there are side effects that are recomputed for every occurrence. This is a thing that we have already seen before. have to pay attention to recursive occurrences of your macros in that sense. So where in the specification of a recursive method, you will just get the desired result in terms of, well, you will recurse into the function call and continue on. Whereas in a rewriting system, as soon as you find a macro to be called, the whole rewriting system will stop at that point. So there is no recursion in these rewriting systems with that. So this will stop the rewriting process at a certain point. And yeah, there's a few other caveats that you get with that. But with that, you can already start doing things that are quite impressive, I would say. So one thing that I found, for example, is a way of kind of extending the underlying programming languages by things that look like native language constructs. For example, let's say we are interested in, well, the running example of the first half of the semester was like parallel programming, so let's start introducing things like atomic blocks in that sense. And for that, I would like to imitate the look and feel that the underlying language like C has. So usually my code blocks are supposed to be in curly brackets, my parameters like to be found in round brackets, and well, there's many other constructs that work in the way that they specify a keyword, then you have a few parameters, and then you have a block. So how about introducing a thing like atomic block and give it, for example, the capability of taking as a parameter some expression that is meant to be used as the lock for this atomic section, and then let's also specify a block to be executed in the critical section in form of an ordinary block, meaning with curly brackets. So defining this with plain macros is not so particularly easy. Usually you would be able, of course, to parameterize the macros that you specify with, well, round brackets and some parameters that you can bind to some text fragments. This would mean, of course, you could also give that as a parameter somehow, but you have to, you would have to put that into these round brackets, kind of breaking the immersion of still being in something which is related to this C-style programming language, meaning that, well, usually in C you find the blocks of some constructs to be outside of the parameters. So yeah. Can you circumvent that somehow? Well, there would be the idea of, well, if you can't do that, maybe you can fit all the code that you need to provide in just this piece and just ignore the following things. This could work for some syntax constructs. However, in our case, the semantics of our thing would impose that we would have like a prefix of the code that is following our construct, as well as a postfix that would have to follow the curly brackets thing afterwards. And this is not so easy to be added to that, or at least it seems. This is all, it's not even a matter of just, well, of just only adding a thing like this release to the end of the macro definition, because there's even situations like the one where you put this atomic block as a child of such a conditional statement. If you do a text replacement on this thing, then this atomic thing gets rewritten with this acquire, the block, and, well, let's ignore the release so far, which means that what we find here as a compiler is then the beginning if statement followed by a valid statement like this acquire thing, and this then followed by a block. So what the compiler would then assume is that the acquire is part of the if statement and the block is just following the complete if statement, which is not what we desired here. We could patch it maybe if we insert a few other curly brackets, but since we cannot really access the space behind this curly brackets part here, this is not so easy to do for us. So how can we mitigate that? And you can actually still work with macros and provide a thing that creates such new syntax if you exploit a few things that are characteristic to the underlying language, particularly the hierarchy in which the strength of the syntactic constructs in terms of binding to following things. So the sequence of statements, for example, is a lot weaker in terms of binding following things to the start than, for example, the if statement in the middle between the condition and the following statement, for example. But you can try to play around with whatever the language gives you to replicate this strength in binding in structure that we can use for trying to specify your particular composition of desire. So that is what you see over here. So here we tackle the problem of wanting to compose some code that we call the to be prepended code to some kind of code block that comes afterwards. And in order to make it bind stronger than, for example, a prepending if statement or beginning of an if statement, we just use an if statement ourselves in order to specify our composition. So what we can do here is specify this part here, which is by itself also an if statement, and specify everything up to here. We leave the last bit away from the whole thing. So if this is okay, because in macro rewriting we don't necessarily have to provide actually valid syntactical elements as the targets to which to rewrite. So we can provide incomplete syntax elements as the content that is to be inlined at the call sites of macros. So what we can do is we can just use this part here as like our content of the macro. And well, what does this do now? Well, it's an if statement, and it's a very particular one that always branches to one side of its if branch, where we now have the chance to specify some code that we want to compose to the following block of the whole thing. Then we do one of these go-tos, which then branches into the other or forks into the other branch of the if statement, where we then have left space for the following block to attach to, so that we can directly continue with the following block. In terms of control flow, what this means is that the whole thing starts with an if block that will never directly go into this into the no branch, because, well, it's just hardwired to always go over to yes, which will then directly call the go to reach the user block, which is the following block afterwards, and then fall through to whatever is behind the whole construct. And in order to fit some code to prepend to the user code into, as well, we just put it in there. So this is the prepended code block from here. So for in terms of composition, in order to prepend some code to user code, this serves quite well. Is there any similar thing that we can use for appending code to some particular block, with still the block being like syntactically the last element that we specify in our program, because only then we can leave it away and use the rest as our macro fragment? Well, we have to be a little bit more creative and add a while loop to the whole thing, because you need some way of jumping back to into the code that you have under control. So the block that is attached to our syntactic construct, that needs to be the last thing in the whole thing, needs to be like the block that is executed within a loop, in that sense, for control to be coming back into the loop again. So what we do here is we begin, similar to the prepending case with our if branch, we immediately branch to our label body, which is hidden somewhere in the rest, maybe not reachable through ordinary means of control if it were not for this go-to. And this is this body label here, which will lead to the execution of the later to be attached block. And, well, now remains to be seen what happens afterwards. And for that, it's actually interesting to see how this follow-up block is nested into our control structures. And we see this is nested inside of a while loop. So after control has passed this this body, we will jump back to the beginning of the loop and reiterate through the whole thing. So with that, we can somehow catch the control flow after we have executed this block and still be in control of things. And this is maybe then a good idea to continue with the code that we want to append to this user-defined block down there. So we do so by mentioning the code then here. So here we can put the appended code into our system. And, well, usually then we, if when we then terminate with this if thing, we would then go back to the while and iterate it again and again and again, since this is a loop. But, well, essentially what we wanted was not a loop, but we wanted to just once have the control back and then exit the whole structure. And this is to be achieved with this break instruction here that will jump out of the loop and out of the complete construct. In terms of control flow, we can try to decipher that with the help of the following diagram. So we start with this if one thing, which will immediately pass on this right branch, yes, which will then go to this user block, which then in the end continues to execute the while loop, which will always branch to the yes side, which will then go to the if, and the if is also hardwired to always branch into the yes branch, and in the case that we see here with the appended code, we can interject here and just put our appended code in there before we break in the end and go to the point where we can continue with ordinary program flow. So, with that, we have means to append code to a block that is syntactically following our current construct, and we can then combine both of these principles by, like, filling the prepended code into a box over here, for example, to come up with this thing, which combines all the approaches from so far, has a segment for prepended code, a segment for appended code, and here the interface to the follow-up block, which is the block of code that is executed between the prepended and the appended code, which will then, in terms of a macro, look like this. So sorry, syntax highlighting here only provides one color since all is just a macro. Haven't found a suitable way to do that without fiddling with the colors manually, so I have to do with that now. So this is just the code that you had in the slides before, with the prepend code being now the acquire of the lock, the append code being the release of the lock, and well, instead of having fixed labels and go-to instructions, what we have here is, well, this is a little trickery in terms of, well, we usually don't want to use the literal same name for the label in this go-to and in the instance where the label is occurring. Because as soon as we start such controls, or if you use such a control structure more than once, we will have labels being not only used, but also specified several times with the same label name. And this is a thing that can't lead to correct code in any way. So we will have to use different, but well, different for each instance of this macro, but within the macro still being the same label here. And, well, this can be achieved by this short trick here with this label macro, which will just concatenate the prefix, which is kind of identifier for this kind of label with some kind of number that is this line constant, which will resort to the line in which this macro has been called, and thus will achieve unique names of labels, at least within one compilation unit. Okay, so with that, you can start going ham wild and start implementing your own control structures that look like ordinary C structs. This will create maximum confusion in your code reviewers' heads. But anyway, so let's see what else is there in terms of metaprogramming. So so far we have had like languages that dealt with other languages. So the compiler tools could be seen as domain-specific languages that were different from the languages that they targeted. Also, this macro preprocessor could be seen as like a language different from the targeted language, in terms of it just being like a term rewriting language on top of some target language. Let's see what we can do when we try to keep to just one language. And this is what homoiconic metaprogramming is all about. So here, the the language that does the accessing of some other program is the same language as the program that is accessed from within. So this really makes code of that particular language a data element of that particular language. So data in that sense is some kind of code, and code can be seen as some kind of data in that sense. And what we can find as instances of that is usually all languages where you have some form of meta classes. There's even some languages that have a thing like the meta object protocol and macro systems in their languages. So let's start with maybe the lowest tier of all that, which would be, well, a thing that you most probably already know, which is reflection. So this is one instance of metaprogramming where you stay in the same language as the code that you're accessing. So a typical example for that is the Java system, where you have, for example, one element that is the instance of keyword. And this is probably quite well known. With that, you can just check for the runtime type of a particular object and then act based on on the thing that you have found out. So far, nothing new. We have had that already in a few slides earlier. The Java system also has a concept for so-called meta classes. So that is a thing that we have not seen before. Well, maybe in your own time, but not in this lecture. So for that, you get a particular type in the Java API, which is this Java lang class thing, which you can use for performing some kind of queries on the underlying type. So you don't even necessarily need to know or have access to the type that you find within some object directly beforehand, but you can even find out something interesting about that. So, how does that work? So, you in some way you obtain an object of that at compile time or at write time of that particular function you know nothing about. The actual object that you obtain in this right-hand side expression is depending on the param value, which is given to you as a string parameter, so you can't actually really say what class name you're gonna get here and what this instance will be typed as, apart from the whole thing being some subclass of object or even object itself. So what do you do in situations like these? Well, you can still obtain the meta object of any object by calling this get class thing, which gets you a sub or an instance of the class, which you can then start to inspect by calling the instance methods. So you can, for example, explore the fields that are declared in a particular class by retrieving them here and get an array of the fields back. For each of the fields, you can then start asking what actual type they have, and also get a class thing and then recurse into that. You can get the actual value out of the original object, I think. Was it like that? The O thingy? I'm not sure whether the code is actually correct at that point. Usually you have to give this get also some kind of reference to the original object, which would be this incognito instead of this O thing. So, yeah. Coding on slides here. But the class, for example, you can then compare to, as you see here, the class for Boolean, and then check whether the value that you have obtained here is actually of a particular well-known value for this Boolean, then, and then react to that with something, or check other things like whether this T is a primitive, for example, and then obtain the numerical value of that, or treat it as an object then in the end and react to these things. So this is typical code that you would use when in a situation wherever you don't know about the actual class in there at all, so to say. And this occurs, for example, if you look at systems where there is a concept of plugins, for example. So you get a class loaded at runtime, which has been not known at the programming time of your complete application, and you load it from externally, but you might be able to make use of it by exploring some properties of that class in terms of well-known names, for example, and then evaluate whatever you find there and try to somehow hook it into your application. So, yeah, what that means, you, for example, can develop things like, yeah, plugins, for example, as an application. So still, this is a technique where you have mostly read-only capabilities on the language, on the targeted language. So what if you want to actually start manipulating whatever you do there? And that is what, for example, the meta object protocol is then. So this is the next tier in that sense. Meta object protocol was an idea, a very elaborate one for, a system of object orientation for the Lisp framework. So there is this CLOS collection of functions and data structures that bring object-oriented features to Lisp. And in there is the so-called meta-object protocol. This is a particular protocol that determines how certain events happen in object orientation, and it gives you the chance to hook yourself into situations where particular events are triggered, and either add your own functionality to that, or even configure certain points within that protocol. What does that mean? Well, there are certain events in the lifetime of such a CLOS program, like creation of classes or objects, that can be interjected and added with your own code, creation of new properties and methods within these classes and objects. There is also ways of specifying that there is meant to be inheritance relations between certain classes of within the CLOS world, and you can specify how these inheritance relations between classes are playing out. You can, for example, let's take things like multiple inheritance. You can just configure the way that multiple inheritance works there in terms of how method calls are resolved or dispatched by just plugging the actual methods for resolution of these method calls in there, for example. So this is highly configurable in that sense. You also have things like the these bunch of fellows here, which are termed here the creation of generic method definitions. This is nothing to do with what you know from Java programming in terms of generics, but this is to do with the so a generic method definition in the Silos sense is meant to be a particular signature, so a type for a method in terms of name and parameters that is the, used in order to do multiple dispatching then later on. So the generic method is like the basic signature, which is then later on dispatched to particular method implementations, possibly based on specializers that are provided there. So you can configure that there's things like multi-methods in there where you do actual multiple dispatching, or whether there's just plain overriding with single dynamic dispatching in that sense. And yeah, so these are all things that you can customize in this meta object protocol in that sense. Then for purposes where you have, for example, such a generic method that then dispatches to some other method, you can not only just restrict yourself to calling one actual method, you can even have things like method combination here. So you can specify things that we know from aspect-oriented programming, where you specify that you want to execute one of the method candidates before the next one in terms of, well, whatever order you have specified actually in this dispatching grounds. After, well, it takes it the other way around. Even things like around and call next method are like the around and proceed in the aspect-oriented world. So you can surround the, for example, a more special, a more special method with a more generic one, or the other way around, and nest them into each other if you desire so. That's completely left open here, but you can configure things like that. You can even specify custom method combinators, not only the ones that are pre-given. Like you could do things like actual arithmetic combinations like this addition or max, or you can do like other data manipulations like creating lists with append for each of the results of each dispatching target. And do all kinds of crazy things for that. Well, there's also ways of mechanizing the generation of documentation, but this is probably not so exciting as all the rest. So there's a lot of things that you can specialize and configure in such a system, and well, this is one way of manipulating how the control flow in programs might work. But still, this is still one step away from like the actual real rewriting of runtime code, and this is what we're going to see now in macros, or even hygienic macros. So for that, we look at, well, essentially Lisp dialect that is available on your Java Virtual Machine, which is Clojure, but it's in principle every Lisp dialect would do. So programs in such a system are special in the sense that their representation in the memory is done in the same way as data is usually represented, or code is represented in the program general. So there's just one data structure in the whole language that is used for everything, even for the runtime code representation, and this is these symbolic expressions or S expressions. This is just like nested generic trees, in that an S expression is either an atom, in that sense a leaf of such a tree, or an expression of the form x dot y in round brackets, with x and y being S expressions. And well, what usually is done in Lisp is that you you look at a particular form of trees, which is a very degenerated tree, particularly a list, so a tree of that form here, which is always tuples, with the innermost tuple here being a pair with the special atom, which is the empty list designator in that sense, and all the other elements in here are just, well, atoms or sometimes also lists, depending on whether you need to have them at that position. And you can abbreviate that then with just enumerating the elements of that list in order and surrounding them with round brackets. So these are the basic elements of the whole language. And the language itself is then just special instances of lists, and their special forms are usually they are usually disambiguated from each other by looking at the first element of each list, which tells us what particular how to interpret this particular instance of a list. So all these list expressions here are different special forms here that do particular things. Like here you see an if condition, then else special form. They have let binding, with let and a particular binding in some child expression. You have the introduction of some symbol as a variable. We have definitions of symbols in general. We have definitions of functions with a name, parameters, and some body. There is a loop which defines some bindings and an actual body of the loop. We have the recur special form that, depending on whether it's used in a child expression of the function or the loop, usually recurs back to the start of the either loop or function. So you can either do recursive function calls with that, or you can restart at the beginning of the loop, for example. Then there is the kind of speciality in there, which we will see later on, which is this quote and eval pair of special forms, which is there in order to deal with uninterpreted lists that can be specified with a quote and then evaluated for whatever special form there is and executed with this eval special form. This is what we will use for metaprogramming now a little bit later on. So what we'll talk about here now specifically is one part of the language, which is the one that has to do with macros. So these macros are transformations of the parse tree of such a program, and the specialty here is that you can actually configure how to rewrite your parse tree of your current program. So you can, with that sense, directly manipulate the program that you're executing currently. So since the program is represented by these kind of lists anyway, all you do there is specifying transformations on lists, yielding new lists depending on whatever parameter lists you get there. So this is due to everything just being a list is quite easy in that sense to do. So as the one of the design principles of this language is or one of the design principles of this language is based on, well, if we have such strong means as macros, well, we can try to minimize the amount of actual special forms that need to be supported by the underlying runtime system and try to implement as many language features as possible just with macros and do actual syntax tree transformations in order to achieve whatever special purpose language construct we want to have, and add everything that is just like a syntactic sugaring of the basic functionality that there is in form of the special forms to the language in form of macros. So an example for that is like the while loop that is accessible in the standard libraries in that sense, and this is accessible in form of just a macro, and you can, for example, inspect how this while loop is actually implemented in this form. So what you do is you do a call to the macro expand, which is the way to decipher what this macro actually really does, and you give it, let's ignore this tick for a while, you give it this while in a generic form, while A and B, and what will be yielded from that is that this while is just an instance of the loop special form with no local bindings, and the body consists in when macro together with our things A and B that we had before, and this recur thing, which was a special form that we had earlier on, which is the one that we said would, in the context of a loop, just jump back to this one here. So we can then wonder what this when is all about, and then we can have a look at that with macro expand. When is also a macro and is defined with the help of the underlying if thing, and what it does is if A, then do B in that sense. So you can, in that sense, iteratively try to explore what these macros do, and even the a lot of the basic control structures that you might be used to when programming with Lisp are in are given in form of just macros. So how can you introduce a new macro? This is what you do with the define macro form, and you see an example definition here, or well, an an example here. So this is a new macro introduced with this def macro, which is called infix, and you can add a string for documentation purposes that is like the doc comment for Java or C++ in that sense. So this just doesn't have anything to do with semantics, it just explains that we convert infix to prefix notation with that. So a parameter for that is given here in these square brackets. This is the accessed with infix. And what we will then do in this macro is we will return a new list. So this is the list constructor with the elements that are, well, function applications here, second of infix. So this will access the second element in infixed. Then first of infixed, and then last of infixed. So all these second, first, and last are in that sense function names that are applied to the parameter, and they do what they say here in their names. So this is the second element of the list infixed, this is the first element of the list infixed, and this is the last element of the, or last elements in that sense, of the list infixed. So when called on such a thing here, so this is now the macro infix applied to a parameter which itself is again a list consisting of three elements. What it will do is it will create, well, first of all, it will return two, so it does the addition. But why does it do so? Well, it does so because the what you do is you, in the infix, you look up what it does. Infix takes the creates a new list like this one here. So this is the new list that is created. It first of all obtains the second element of the parameter, which is this plus symbol, and moves it here. Then the first one, which is this one, and moves it here. And then whatever remains, which is this bugger, and goes there. And then this is usually executed directly, which is why we return a plus here. So, yeah, prefix notation is like what the general execution mode in Lisp is. Yes.
Does this work also if we provide a list that doesn't have exactly three
lines? As far as I remember, don't kill me if it's not the case, but as far as I remember, this last matches everything that remains. But you must imagine this is like 10 or 12 different programming languages in there. I might be wrong. I don't know all of them by heart anyway. But usually there is some way of matching the rest of some list some way. Okay. Good. What you might have noticed so far is that we have had all these little ticks hidden somewhere in our codes, and you might wonder what that actually is. And having a tick in front of something is equivalent syntax to just this quote special form. And what that means is that everything that we find behind that is taken literally without any interpretation. It's not executed directly, but taken as like data. So when I have some keyword here, this is not executed or interpreted, but reported directly and to be used as data in that sense, until at some point we execute an eval on that, and with that evaluate the thing again. So, yeah. This is why there's a difference in having this infix here actually being evaluated to two, and here having that as a parameter that we can pass around and analyze for whatever that actually really does. Yeah? Okay. Good. So you might wonder whether you can do actual meaningful things with that apart from your replacing one thing with the other in order to achieve some kind of syntactic sugar. And you can actually try to really implement programs with that, but rest assured, this is not an easy thing. If you are used to just ordinary programming, just getting all the places right where you have to quote and have to go back to unquoted is an actual chore, and it's not so easily done. So anyway, let's have a look at the factorial, which we usually know how to implement. And if we would do so in ordinary Lisp, what we would do is the version from that side. This is the ordinary function call recursion based version. So we define a function, faculty, in this case 2, because the metaprogramming version is the one from before with parameter n. And what we do is we define this as the following list thing. And this list consists of like an if special form with a condition that is an equality test of two parameters, n and 0, n is taken from the parameters list, and if that is the case, then the next element of this list being like the then part of the if expression is the 1, and the last list element is in that sense just the else part, which is again in list form a multiplication between n and another expression, which is a recursive call to faculty 2 in that sense, with parameters n being diminished by 1. So this is usual recursive programming as we know it. How would the metaprogramming version look like? This is what we see on the other side. So this is the metaprogramming version. It starts with def macro instead of defined function. So far, so good. We also implement an if construction. And the only thing that we will now do is instead of actually recursing, because this would be just ordinary function calls, what we will do is we will provide here actual expressions in form of this list here. So this is creating a new list that represents the result of this macro, which consists of a list started with multiplication followed by the n from the parameters, which will be directly inserted here. Then the second element, the third element of this list being the second operand of the multiplication, is another list that represents another instance of this macro here, one parameterized with a thing that is evaluated straight here to n minus 1. And this is what is given back. If we execute both of them, turns out that both of them yield the same result. So you can test that through and see that this holds for other parameters as well. What is actually created on the left-hand side, you might wonder? Well, what you get from one call to this fuck one is not an actual real result in that sense, but an intermediary step, which consists in the list that we have created here. So this is the actual result here, which consists in the list starting with the multiplication, and the original parameter here, and then again, another list thingy, which consists in a function call, parameterized with now not the expression n minus 1, but with the actual evaluated version 3. So what we have, what this macro does usually is it rewrites whatever has been there before. So this FAQ1.4 is rewritten into times 4 and FAQ1 of 3. And, well, usually this is then recursively applied. So macros in Lisp here can be applied recursively. And this is continued. You can do that until you have replaced all the macros with a thing like this one here, this macro expand all, which will recursively do macro expansion. And you will see that in the end, what you have created is you've replaced the original function call with four here with like just this chain of multiplications that have been produced by this line here in a recursive manner. So is that any way different to the original function call that is recursive in that sense? You might wonder. And the difference is not in the result, of course, that's still the same. It's the same function after all. But you've done different actions here. So what you do in macros is you do static syntax tree transformations here. So before you start, well, partially you do executions in there. For example, in here you have already interpreted subtraction. So this is happening in each macro expansion anyway. So this is a thing that is already executed. But other than that, what the only thing that you do is, in that sense, you do transformations of the syntax tree in each recursive iteration of the macro, whereas in functions, what you do is the code remains the same throughout the whole execution of the thing, but the only thing that that changes there is like the instruction pointer and the runtime stack in that sense, whereas during the static AST transformation, the runtime stack doesn't contain any function frames or anything, no activation records, so because you don't build up the intermediate results on the stack while you do that, but you instead manipulate the syntax tree directly before you actually start evaluating, and then in the end you will only evaluate a large expression in that sense, which is also of course using a little bit of stack in that sense, but it does not really introduce new stack frames on the stack, so it's a lot less intermediate space that is taken on the stack in the metaprogramming version than in the recursive call version, at least if you consider naive function execution instead of like tail recursive ones, for example, tail recursion optimized ones. So these are different means of execution that you have. On the one side, you do syntax transformations on the go, and on the other side, you remain with the same syntax, but use the stack in order to store your intermediate results in that sense. So, yeah. Apart from that, well, what you get from that is then that macros, in that sense, replicate parameter forms, whereas functions usually evaluate the parameters once and then work with the values from that. So in macros, the parameters are uninterpreted and are not necessarily valid expressions. It's just generic lists in that sense that you can manipulate through these macros, versus in functions where parameters need to be actual valid expressions. Another aspect is there because macros, together with this duality of eval and quote, are in some form or another usually part of other languages as well. So far as far as I know, there's also, I think JavaScript also even has things like this eval quote dualism. I don't know whether there's any JavaScript people in there. No. Okay, but usually there's also some way of doing this kind of manipulations in JavaScript with this duality between quote and eval. But anyway, what is special about Lisp here and why this is like such a big thing in the theory of like metaprogramming is the concept of a macro hygiene, which has to do with this fact that, well, so if anything is interpreted without any semantics and concepts from underlying languages like scoping and all that, what you might get is some unwanted side effects of your programming. For example, take the following code where you have introduced some variable under the name variable with value 42, and some macro mac that gets some parameters, stuff to do, and then what it will do is here it will introduce a new or will be replaced or expanded with this let expression that will bind the value 4711 to the name variable in this stuff to do thing. What then will happen when you do println of the variable is, well, in principle, you would have referred to this variable name from this inner variable here, because this is just an expansion of uninterpreted terms in that sense. So you could have shadowed the actual value from before, which is a thing which is quite bad, so to say. So in order to clean up with that, there's this concept of macro hygiene, where you are able to introduce like names like this variable hash, where you then generate new symbols that actually avoid this collision in that sense. So this is this is the special thing about this macro implementation in Lisp. So if you're if that now like activated your appetite for metaprogramming and all, this is just a small introduction, and you can have a look at the references that are used for that. For example, if you're more interested in these C++ shenanigans, in these C preprocessor shenanigans, creating your own control structures, you might be interested in this one here. In order to talk about or to find out more about metaprogramming in Lisp or in this Java-based Lisp dialect, you might be interested in this one here. And finally, then there's also a reference for this MetaObject protocol over here, where you're more interested in configuring your object-oriented system to the maximum, then you might be interested in this one here. So with that, I'm done with metaprogramming and the lecture for today. And next time, you're going to have an introduction in coroutines and continuations. So that's all for today. Then wish you